There were differences, Susan had to admit. Two different lives had indeed burned their unique tracks on the faces. And the selves had been born a second or so apart, and a lot of the universe can change in a second. Think of identical twins, she told herself. But they are two different selves, occupying bodies that at least start out identical. They don't start out as identical selves. He looks quite like me, said Lobsang, and Susan blinked. She leaned closer to the unconscious form of Jeremy. Say that again, she said. I said, he looks quite like me, said Lobsang. Susan glanced at Lady Lejeune, who said, I saw it too, Susan. Oh, so what? Said Lobsang. What are you two hiding from me? His lips move when you speak, said Susan. They try to form the same words.
He can pick up my thoughts.
It's more complicated than that, I think. Susan picked up a limp hand and gently pinched the web of skin between thumb and forefinger. Lobsang winced and glanced at his own hand. A patch of white skin was reddening again.
Not just thoughts, said Susan. This close, you feel his pain. Your speech controls his lips.
Lobsang stared down at Jeremy.
Then what will happen, he said slowly, when he comes round?
I'm wondering the same thing, said Susan. Perhaps you shouldn't be here.
But this is where I have to be.
We at least should not stay here, said Lady Lejeune. I know my kind. They will have been discussing what to do. The signs will not hold them forever, and I have run out of soft centres.
What are you supposed to do when you are where you're supposed to be? Said Susan. Lobsang reached down and touched Jeremy's hand with his fingertip. The world went white. Susan wondered later if this was what it would be like at the heart of a star. It wouldn't be yellow. You wouldn't see fire. There would just be the searing whiteness of every overloaded sense screaming all at once. It faded, gradually, into a mist. The walls of the room appeared, but she could see through them. There were other walls beyond, and other rooms, transparent as ice, and visible only at the corners and where the light caught them. In each one, another Susan was turning to look at her. The rooms went on forever. Susan was sensible. It was, she knew, a major character flaw. It did not make you popular or cheerful, and, this seemed to her to be the most unfair bit, it didn't even make you right. But it did make you definite, and she was definite that what was happening around her was not, in any accepted sense, real. That was not in itself a problem. Most of the things humans busied themselves with weren't real, either. But sometimes the mind of the most sensible person encountered something so big, so complex, so alien to all understanding, that it told itself little stories about it instead. Then, when it felt it understood the story, it felt it understood the huge, incomprehensible thing. And this, Susan knew, was her mind telling itself a story. There was a sound like great heavy metal doors slamming, one after another, getting louder and faster. The universe reached a decision. The other glass rooms vanished, the walls clouded, colour rose pastel at first, then darkening as timeless reality flowed back. The bed was empty. Lobsang had gone. But the air was full of slivers of blue light, turning and swirling like ribbons in a storm. Susan remembered to breathe again. "Oh," she said aloud, "destiny." She turned. The bedraggled Lady Lejeune was still staring at the empty bed.
"Is there another way out of here?" "There's an elevator at the end of the corridor, Susan, but what happened to—"
"Not Susan," said Susan sharply. "It's Miss Susan. I'm only Susan to my friends, and you are not one of them. I don't trust you at all."
"I don't trust me either," said Lady Lejeune meekly. "Does that help?"
"Show me this elevator, will you?" It turned out to be nothing more than a large box the size of a small room, which hung from a web of ropes and pulleys in the ceiling. It had been installed recently, by the look of it, to move the large works of art around. Sliding doors occupied most of one wall.
"There are capstans in the cellar for when she get up," said Lady Lejeune. downward journeys are slowed safely because of a mechanism by which the weight of the descending elevator causes water to be pumped up into rainwater cisterns on the roof, which in turn can be released back into a hollow counterweight that assists in the elevation of heavier items of...
Thank you, said Susan quickly. But what it really needs in order to descend is time. Under her breath, she added, Can you help?
The ribbons of blue light orbited her, like puppies anxious to play, and then drifted towards the elevator.
However, she added, I believe time is on our side now.
Miss Tangerine was amazed at how fast a body learned. Until now, auditors had learned by counting. Sooner or later, everything came down to numbers. If you knew all the numbers, you knew everything. Often the later was a lot later, but that did not matter, because for an auditor, time was just another number. But a brain, a few soggy pounds of gristle, counted numbers so fast that they stopped being numbers at all. She'd been astonished at how easily it could direct a hand to catch a ball in the air, calculating future positions of hand and ball without her even being aware of it. The senses seemed to operate and present her with conclusions before she had time to think. At the moment, she was trying to explain to other auditors that not feeding an elephant when there was no elephant not to feed was not, in fact, impossible. Miss Tangerine was one of the faster-learning auditors and had already formulated a group of things, events, and situations that she categorized as bloody stupid. Things that were bloody stupid could be dismissed. Some of the others were having difficulty understanding this, but now she stopped in mid-harangue when she heard the rumble of the lift.
"Do we have anyone upstairs?" she demanded.
The auditors around her shook their heads. Ignore this notice had produced too much confusion.
"Then someone is coming down," said Miss Tangerine. "They are out of place. They must be stopped."
"We must discuss," an auditor began.
"Do what I say, you organic organ."
"It's a matter of personalities," said Lady Lejean, as Susan pushed open a door in the roof and stepped out onto the leads.
"Yes," said Susan, looking around at the silent city. "I thought you didn't have them."
"They will have them now," said Lady Lejean, climbing out behind her, "and personalities define themselves in terms of other personalities."
Susan, prowling along the parapet, considered this strange sentence.
"You mean there will be flaming rows?" she said.
"Yes, we have never had egos before."
"Well, you seem to be managing."
"Only by becoming completely and utterly insane," said her ladyship.
Susan turned. Lady Lejeune's hat and dress had become even more tattered, and she was shedding sequins. And then there was the matter of the face. An exquisite mask on a bone structure like fine china, which had been made up by a clown. Probably a blind clown. And one who was wearing boxing gloves. In a fog. Lady Lejeune looked at the world through panda eyes, and her lipstick touched her mouth only by accident.
"You don't look insane," lied Susan.
"As such."
"Thank you. But sanity is defined by the majority, I'm afraid. Do you know the saying, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts?"
"Of course." Susan scanned the rooftops for a way down. She did not need this. The thing seemed to want to talk, or rather to chatter aimlessly.
"It is an insane statement. It is a nonsense. But now I believe that it is true."
"Good. That lift should be getting down about now." Slivers of blue light, like trout slipping through a stream, danced around the elevator door. The auditors gathered. They had been learning. Many of them had acquired weapons, and a number of them had taken care not to communicate to the others that gripping something offensive in the hand seemed a very natural thing to do. It spoke to something right down in the back of the brain. It was therefore unfortunate that when a couple of them pulled open the elevator door, it was to reveal, slightly melting in the middle of the floor, a cherry liqueur chocolate. The scent wafted. There was only one survivor, and when Miss Tangerine ate the chocolate, there wasn't even that. "One of life's little certainties," said Susan, standing on the edge of the museum's parapet,
is that there is generally a last chocolate hidden in all those empty wrappers. Then she reached down and grabbed the top of a drainpipe. She wasn't certain how this would work. If she fell... But would she fall? There was no time to fall. She had her own personal time. In theory, if anything so definite as a theory existed in a case like this, that meant she could just drift down to the ground. But the time to test a theory like that was when you had no other choice. A theory was just an idea, but a drainpipe was a fact. The blue light flickered around her hands.
"Lobsang," she said quietly, "it is you, isn't it?"
"That name is as good as any for us."
The voice was as faint as a breath.
"This may seem a stupid question, but where are you?"
"We are just a memory. And I am weak."
"Oh."
Susan slid a little further.
"But I will grow strong. Get to the clock."
"What's the point? There was nothing we could do."
"Times have changed."
Susan reached the ground. Lady Lejeune followed, moving clumsily. Her evening dress had acquired several more tears.
"Can I offer a fashion tip?" said Susan.
"It would be welcomed," said her ladyship politely.
"Long cerise bloomers with that dress? Not a good idea."
"No. They are very colourful and quite warm. What should I have chosen instead?"
"With that cut, practically nothing."
"That would have been acceptable?"
Susan blanched at unfolding the complex laws of lingerie to someone who wasn't even, she felt, anybody.
"To anyone likely to find out, yes," she finished. "It would take too long to explain."
Lady Lejeune sighed.
"All of it does," she said. "Even clothing. Skin substitutes to preserve body heat, so simple, so easy to say. But there are so many rules and exceptions, impossible to understand."
Susan looked along Broadway. It was thick with silent traffic, but there was no sign of an auditor. "We'll run into more of them," she said aloud.
"Yes, there will be hundreds at least," said Lady Lejeune.
"Why?"
"Because we have always wondered what life is like."
"Then let's get up into Zephyr Street," said Susan.
"What is there for us?"
"Wienrich and Bircher."
"Who are they?"
"I think the original Herr Wienrich and Frau Bircher died a long time ago. But the shop still does very good business,"
said Susan, darting across the street.
"We need ammunition."
Lady Lejeune caught up.
"Oh, they make chocolate,"
she said. "There's a bear poo in the woods," said Susan, and realized her mistake straight away. Teaching small children for any length of time can do this to a vocabulary. Too late. Lady Lejeune looked thoughtful for a moment.
"Yes,"
she said at last.
"Yes, I believe that most varieties do indeed excrete, as you suggest, at least in the temperate zones, but there are several that—"
"I meant to say that, yes, they make chocolate,"
said Susan. "Vanity, vanity," thought Lutze, as the milk cart rattled through the silent city. "Ronnie would have been like a god, and people of that stripe don't like hiding. Not really hiding. They like to leave a little clue. Some emerald tablet somewhere, some code in some tomb under the desert, something to say to the keen researcher, I was here and I was great." What else had the first people been afraid of? Night, maybe? Cold? Bears? Winter? Stars? The endless sky? Spiders? Snakes? One another. People had been afraid of so many things. He reached into his pack for the battered copy of The Way and opened it at random. Koan 97. Do unto otters as you would have them do unto you. No real help there. Besides, he'd occasionally been unsure that he'd written that one down properly, although it had certainly worked. He'd always left aquatic mammals well alone, and they had done the same to him. He tried again. Koan 124. It's amazing what you see if you keep your eyes open.
"What's the book, monk?" said Ronnie.
"Oh, just a little book," said Lutze.
He looked around. The cart was passing a funeral parlour. The owner had invested in a large plate glass window, even though the professional undertaker does not, in truth, have that much to sell that looks good in a window, and they usually make do with dark, sombre drapes, and perhaps a tasteful urn. And the name of the fifth horseman.
Ha!
Said Lutze, quietly.
Something funny, monk. Obvious when you come to think about it, said Lutze,
as much to himself as to Ronnie. Then he turned in his seat and stuck out his hand.
Pleased to meet you, he said. Let me guess your name.
And said it.
Susan had been unusually inexact. To call Wienrich and Bircher chocolate makers was like calling Leonard of Querm a decent painter who also tinkered with things, or Death not someone you'd want to meet every day. It was accurate, but it didn't tell the whole story. For one thing, they didn't make, they created. There's an important difference, up to $10 a pound, usually. And while their select little shop sold the results, it didn't do anything so crass as to fill the window with them. That would suggest, well, over-eagerness. Generally, W&B had a display of silk and velvet drapes, with, on a small stand, perhaps one of their special pralines, or no more than three of their renowned frosted caramels. There was no price tag. If you had to ask the price of W&B's chocolates, you couldn't afford them. And if you tasted one, and still couldn't afford them, you'd save and scrimp and rob and sell elderly members of your family for just one more of those mouthfuls that fell in love with your tongue and turned your soul to whipped cream. There was a discreet drain in the pavement in case people standing in front of the window drooled too much. Wienrich and Bircher were, naturally, foreigners, and according to Ankh Morpork's Guild of Confectioners, they did not understand the peculiarities of the city's taste buds. Ankh Morpork people, said the guild, were hearty, no-nonsense folk who did not want chocolate that was stuffed with cocoa liquor, and were certainly not effete, lardy-dar foreigners who wanted cream in everything. In fact, they actually preferred chocolate made mostly from milk, sugar, suet, hooves, lips, miscellaneous squeezings, rat droppings, plaster, flies, tallow, bits of tree, hair, lint, spiders, and powdered cocoa husks. This meant that according to the food standards of the great chocolate centres in Borogravia and Querm, Ankh Morpork chocolate was formerly classed as cheese, and only escaped through being the wrong colour, being defined as tile grout. Susan allowed herself one of their cheaper boxes per month, and she could easily stop at the first layer if she wanted to. "You needn't come in," she said, as she opened the shop door. Rigid customers lined the counter. "Please call me Miriam. I don't think I—" "Please," said Lady Lejeune meekly. "A name is important." Suddenly, in spite of everything, Susan felt a brief pang of sympathy for the creature. "Oh, very well. Miria, you needn't come in."
"I can stand it."
"But I thought chocolate was a raging temptation," said Susan, being firm with herself.
"It is."
They stared up at the shelves behind the counter.
"Miria, Miria," said Susan, speaking only some of her thoughts aloud, "from the Ephesian word mirios, meaning innumerable, and le Jean is a crude pun of legion." "Oh, dear."
"We thought that a name should say what a thing is," said her ladyship, "and there is safety in numbers. I'm sorry."
"Well, these are their basic assortments," said Susan, dismissing the shop display with a wave of her hand. "Let's try the back room. Are you all right?"
"I'm fine. I am fine," murmured Lady Lejeune, swaying.
"You're not going to pig out on me, are you?"
"I know about willpower. The body craves the chocolate, but the mind does not. At least so I tell myself. And it must be true. The mind can overrule the body. Otherwise, what is it for?"
"I've often wondered," said Susan, pushing open another door. "Ah, the magician's cave."
"Magic? They use magic here?"
"Nearly right." Lady Lejeune leaned on the doorframe for support when she saw the tables.
"Oh," she said, "I
can't detect sugar, milk, butter, cream, vanilla, hazelnuts, almonds, walnuts, raisins, orange peel, various liqueurs, citrus pectin, strawberries, raspberries, essence of violets, cherries, pineapples, pistachios, oranges, limes, lemons, coffees, cocoa.
Nothing there to be frightened of, right? Said Susan, surveying the workshop for useful weaponry. Cocoa is just a rather bitter bean, after all.
Yes, but...
Lady Lejean clenched her fists, shut her eyes and bared her teeth.
Put them all together and they make...
Steady, steady.
The will can overrule the emotions. The will can overrule the instincts,
the auditor intoned. Good, good. Now just work your way up to the bit where it says chocolate, okay?
That's the hard one.
In fact, it seemed to Susan, as she walked past the vats and counters, that chocolate lost some of its attraction when you saw it like this. It was the difference between seeing the little heaps of pigment and seeing the whole picture. She selected a syringe that seemed designed to do something intensely personal to female elephants, although she decided that here it was probably used for doing the wiggly bits of decoration. And over here was a small vat of cocoa liquor. She stared around at the trays and trays of fondant, creams, marzipans and caramels. Oh, and here was an entire table of soul-cake eggs. But they weren't the hollow-shelled, cardboard-tasting presents for children, oh no. These were the confectionery equivalent of fine, intricate jewellery. Out of the corner of her eye she saw movement. One of the statue-like workers, bent over her tray of praline dreams, was shifting almost imperceptibly. Time was flowing into the room. Pale blue light glinted in the air. She turned and saw a vaguely human figure hovering beside her. It was featureless and as transparent as mist, but in her head it said, "I'm stronger. You are my anchor, my link to this world. Can you guess how hard it is to find it again in so many? Get me to the clock."
Susan turned and thrust the icing syringe into the arms of groaning Miria.
"Grab that, and make some kind of sling or something. I want you to be carrying as many of those chocolate eggs as possible, and the creams, and the liqueurs, understand? You can do it."
Oh, gods, there was no alternative. The poor thing needed some kind of morale boost.
"Please, Miria. And that's a stupid name. You're not many, you're one, okay? Just be yourself. Unity." That'd be a good name.
The new Unity raised a mascara-streaked face.
Yes, it is. It's a good name.
Susan snatched as much merchandise as she could carry, aware of some rustling behind her, and turned to find Unity standing to attention, holding by the look of it a bench worth of assorted confectionery in a sort of big cerise sack.
Oh, good. "Intelligence use of the materials to hand," said Susan weakly. Then the teacher within her cut in and added, "I hope you brought enough for everybody."
"You were the first," said Lutze. "You basically created the whole business. Innovative, you were."
"That was then," said Ronnie Soak. "It's all changed now."
"Not like it used to be," agreed Lutze.
"Take death," said Ronnie Soak. "Impressive, I'll grant you. And who doesn't look good in black? But, after all, death, what's death?"
"Just a big sleep," said Lutze.
"Just a big sleep," said Ronnie Soak. "As for the others, war? If war's so bad, why do people keep doing it?"
"Practically a hobby," said Lutze.
He began to roll himself a cigarette.
"Practically a hobby," said Ronnie Soak. "As for famine and pestilence, well..."
"Enough said," said Lutze sympathetically.
"Exactly. I mean, famine's a fearful thing, obviously,
in an agricultural community, but you've got to move with the times," said Lutze,
putting the roll-up in his mouth.
"You've put your finger right on it. You've got to move with the times. I mean, does your average city person fear famine?"
"No, he thinks food grows in shops," said Lutze.
He was beginning to enjoy this. He had 800 years' worth of experience in steering the thoughts of his superiors, and most of them had been intelligent. He decided to strike out a little.
"Fire now. City folk really fear fire," he said. "That's new. Your primitive villager, he reckoned fire was a good thing, didn't he? Kept the wolves away. If it burned down his hut, well, logs and turf are cheap enough. But now he lives in a street of crowded wooden houses, and everyone's cooking in their rooms. Well,
Ronnie glared.
Fire? Fire? That's just a demigod. Some little tea-leaf pinches the flame from the gods, and suddenly he's immortal. You call that training and experience?
A spark leapt from his fingers and ignited the end of Lutze's cigarette.
And as for the gods...
Johnny come lately to back of them, said Lutze quickly.
Right. People started worshipping them because they were afraid of me, said Ronnie. Did you know that?
No, really? Said Lutze innocently.
But now Ronnie sagged.
That was then, of course, he said. It's different now. I'm not what I used to be.
No, no, obviously not, no, said Lutze soothingly. But it's all a matter of how you look at it, am I correct? Now, supposing a man, that is to say, a...
Anthropomorphic personification, said Ronnie Soak. But I've always preferred the term avatar.
Lutze's brow wrinkled.
You fly around a lot, he said.
That would be aviator.
Sorry, well, supposing an avatar, thank you, who was perhaps a bit ahead of his time thousands of years ago, well, supposing he took a good look around now, he might just find the world is ready for him again.
Lutze waited.
My abbot now, he reckons you are the bee's knees, he said, for a little reinforcement.
Does he? Said Ronnie Soak, suspiciously.
Bee's knees, cat's pyjamas, and dog's, elbows,
Lutze finished.
He's written scrolls and scrolls about you, says you are hugely important in understanding how the universe works.
Yeah, but he's just one man, said Ronnie Soak,
with all the sullen reluctance of someone cuddling a lifetime's huge snit like a favourite soft toy.
Technically, yes, said Lutze. But he's an abbot, and brainy? He thinks such big thoughts he needs a second lifetime just to finish them off. Let a lot of peasants fear famine, I say, but someone like you should aim for quality. And you look at the cities now. Back in the old days, there were just heaps of mud bricks with names like and and Ag. These days there's millions of people living in cities, very, very complicated cities. Just you think about what they really, really fear. And fear, well, fear is belief, hmm?
There was another long pause.
Well, all right, but,
Ronnie began,
of course, they won't be living in them very long, because by the time the grey people have finished taking them to pieces to see how they work, there won't be any belief left.
My customers do depend on me, Ronnie Soak mumbled.
What customers? That's Soak speaking, said Lutze. That's not the voice of Chaos.
Ha! Said Chaos, bitterly. You haven't told me yet how you worked that one out.
Because I've got more than three brain cells, and you're vain, and you painted your actual name back to front on your cart, whether you knew it or not, and a dark window is a mirror, and K and S are still recognisable in a reflection, even when they're back to front, thought Lutze. But that wasn't a good way forward.
It was just obvious, he said. You sort of shine through. It's like putting a sheet over an elephant. You might not be able to see it, but you're sure the elephant's still there.
Chaos looked wretched.
I don't know, he said. It's been a long time.
Oh, and I thought you said you were number one, said Lutze, deciding on a new approach. Sorry. Still, I suppose it's not your fault. You've lost a few skills over the centuries. What with one thing and...
Lost skills? Snapped Chaos, waving a finger under the sweeper's nose. I could certainly take you to the cleaners, you little maggot.
What with a dangerous yoghurt?
Said Lutze, climbing off the cart.
Chaos leapt down after him. Where'd you get off, talking to me like that?
He demanded. Lutze glanced up.
Corner of Merchant and Broadway, he said. So what?
Chaos roared. He tore off his striped apron and his white cap. He seemed to grow in size. Darkness evaporated off him like smoke. Lutze folded his hands and grinned.
Remember Rule One, he said.
Rules! Rules! I'm Chaos!
Who was the first? Said Lutze.
Yes!
Creator and Destroyer.
Right.
Apparently complicated, apparently patternless behaviour that nevertheless has a simple deterministic explanation and is a key to the new levels of understanding of the multidimensional universe.
You'd better believe it.
What? Got to move with the times, mister. Got to keep up,
shouted Lutze excitedly, hopping from foot to foot. "You're what people think you are, and they've changed you. I hope you're good at sums."
"You can't tell me what to do!" Chaos roared. "I'm Chaos!"
"You don't think so? Well, your big comeback ain't going to happen now that the auditors have taken over. The rules, mister. That's what they are. They're cold, dead rules."
Silver lightning flickered in the walking cloud that had once been Ronnie. Then cloud, cart, and horse vanished.
"Well, could have been worse, I suppose," said Lutze to himself. "Not a very bright lad, really. Possibly a bit too old-fashioned."
He turned around and found a crowd of auditors watching him. There were dozens of them. He sighed and grinned his sheepish little grin. He'd had just about enough one day.
"Well, I expect you have heard of Rule 1, right?" he said.
That seemed to give them pause. One said, "We know millions of rules, human."
"Billions, trillions," said another.
"Well, you can't attack me," said Lutze, "'cause of Rule 1.
The nearest auditors went into a huddle.
"It must involve gravitation."
"No, quantum effects, obviously."
"Logically, there cannot be a Rule 1, because at that point there would be no concept of plurality."
"But if there is not a Rule 1, can there be any other rules? If there is no Rule 1, where is Rule 2?
"There are millions of rules. They cannot fail to be numbered."
"Wonderful," thought Lutze. "All I have to do is wait until their heads melt." But an auditor stepped forward. It looked more wild-eyed than the others, and was much more unkempt. It was also carrying an axe.
"We do not have to discuss this," it snapped. "We must think, this is nonsense. We will not discuss it."
"But what is rule?" an auditor began.
"You will call me Mr. White."
"Mr. White, what is Rule 1?
"I am not glad you asked that question," screamed Mr. White,
and swung the axe. The body of the other auditor crumbled in around the blade, dissolving into floating motes that dispersed in a fine cloud.
"Anyone else got any questions?" said Mr. White, raising the axe again.
One or two auditors, not yet entirely in tune with current developments, opened their mouths to speak, and shut them again. Lutze took a few steps back. He prided himself on an incredibly well-honed ability to talk his way in or out of anything, but that rather depended on a passably sane entity being involved at the other end of the dialogue. Mr. White turned to Lutze.
"What are you doing out of your place, organic?"
But Lutze was overhearing another, whispered conversation. It was coming from the other side of a nearby wall, and it went like this.
"Who cares about the damned wording? Accuracy is important, Susan. There is a precise description on the little map inside the lid, look. And do you think that will impress anyone? Please, things should be done properly." "Oh, give it to me, then."
Mr. White advanced on Lutze, axe raised.
"It is forbidden to," he began. "Eat, oh good grief, eat a delicious fondant sugar cream infused with delightfully rich and creamy raspberry filling wrapped in mysterious dark chocolate, you grey bastards."
A shower of small objects pattered down on the street. Several of them broke open. Lutze heard a whine, or rather, the silence caused by the absence of a whine he'd grown used to.
"Oh no, I'm winding down." Thank you.